particularly in relation to Premier's conferences and briefings of the PM on Premier's conference material, and, agenda items and so on, where they felt that they should be getting it because they were the graduates and I was only about three subjects in, into my course, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was quite a number of the economists there at the time were ones that had been in the armed forces, where I was too young for that, and had come out and done their CRTS training after coming back to Australia. But I think people like Bob Dury, I think I was pretty practical in terms of how I handled, I wasn't academic in the way I handled correspondence or briefings and things like that. And I think that sort of attracted their attention and it got them to feed me more work.
Yes, and with the economic division, where were you located physically? Where was the workplace?
Physically in East Block.
Okay, still there.
Yes, still in East Block. I remember some of the earlier stuff I got involved in. I was assistant secretary to the Interdepartmental Committee on GATT, the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade. assistant secretary didn't mean much. It only meant that I was collecting all the statistics and doing all the filing of the stuff coming from GATT and sorting it out in terms of anti-dumping and all that sort of different categorisation, international statistics and things. And I thought this was great.
When would this have been approximately?
It would have been about 1953-54. Oh, okay. And I do a lot of the statistical stuff and you know, graphing our imports, exports and all that sort of thing, and I thought this was pretty magic. And involved in some of the early activities of the Colombo Plan in terms of requests from Asian countries for particular technical support, and I would pass this on to the states or to the other Commonwealth departments who might have the sort of staff that could handle those sort of things. Like if they want a water resource stuff, you know, you'd pass it to the states but also to the Snowy Mountains Authority at that stage. So it became quite interesting, and I felt as if I was doing something at that stage.
And that would have catered for the sort of motives you had for wanting to go to New Guinea, I suppose.
It offset those pretty quickly. Mm. Because, you know, I think if I had that feeling that, you know, I had to be doing something useful, and something useful wasn't just acknowledging letters.
Yep.
I found that I think I only had three subjects in my degree, which meant I'd been in the department for 3 years. When I was appointed acting research officer, for which you had to have a degree. So I was, from then on, there were very few times when I was performing in my substantive position. I was always acting beyond my formal position, and I appreciated that. I mean, I didn't get the money. Well, I did get the money in an acting position, but I didn't get the formal designations. But by the time I finished my degree, I think I was acting senior research officer or something. You know, sort of.
Did your wife continue to work after you were married?
Let me work the children. The first child was about 18 months, so she probably worked for 12 or 15 months after. But then we finished up with six children.
So that's from it. We went about 1955 to
1955 to when did I get to Queensland? 68, until about 68 was the baby.
Can you tell me you know, you mentioned how you lived in Bubiala Street and you were working at East Block. How would you travel to work each day?
I travelled by car or bike.
Or bike, okay.
Yeah.
Because you had a bit of a biking background, didn't you?
Yes.
With school in...
That's right. Certainly when I was at Acton Guest House, I walked. I walked to East Block from there. But when we moved to Bubiala Street, it was bike or car.
Would that be shared car or your own car?
No, own car. And I'd graduated from the little Austin 8 tourer at that stage, and I think to a Hillman wagon, because I could put a couple of kids in the back of the wagon.
And with Old Parliament House, or the Provisional Parliament House as it was in, what's your earliest recollection of actually coming to the building?
Well, I suppose my earliest official contact with the building would have been during Premier's conferences. And this would have been probably from about 1951, 52, as early as that. When my first contact with Premier's conferences was as a messenger. At that stage, the Hansard reporters would take down the debate, and we would get the first rough of that, take it over to Prime Minister's department, and run off the number of copies. Like I wouldn't, but some of the officials would go through it for any corrections and run off the copies and get them back and deliver them to the various state delegations. So I started off as a messenger from East Block to Parliament House. And while on the Premier's conferences, I at one stage, probably into the 60s, I probably had more association with Premier's conferences than anyone else, having started from that courier position preparing briefs for the Prime Minister, to sort of formally putting some of the reports together later. And the final one, it must have been 68, because it would have been in John Gordon's time as chairman, but I was sitting up at the centre table with Jeff Yeend. Mm-hmm. Jeff was the senior advisor and head of the department at the time, and I was up advising Jeff. So I worked my way right through from courier to, no, not right through, but sitting up at the table with the PM and his senior advisor. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. I guess before you came to Canberra, you would have been aware of the Parliament House building, and is that right, or is that right?
Only in that I'd, from schooling, which was fairly minimal those days in terms of, you did history and geography and whatever. So in as far as it came into the history bit, you would have had a little, but then again, there wasn't a lot of Australian history in that sort of, say, up to 46. Most of our history was British, mm-hmm. British history since Industrial Revolution days. So there wasn't a lot of knowledge of Parliament House, pretty limited. 1927 was known, and a few things like that, reps and Senate, and the requirement of the Governor General to assent to bills and things. We knew some of the basics, but that was it.
Other people have said a similar thing, and it makes me think that the iconic sort of nature of the building is quite recent. I'm wondering if it's a bicentenary, perhaps, or whether, I'm old enough to be able to remember the 60s and 70s, and I don't, Yeah, I think, you know, we would have seen in Melbourne, we would have seen Old Parliament House on television occasionally, but it didn't seem to have that iconic status.
No, I think it might have acquired the iconic status once the new Parliament House was built.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And it's, you know, it bothers me that people want to keep old things just because they're old, but and you know, what's wrong with taking photographs and, you know, putting them on disc or something? I think the concept of this building probably grew when the new one was built. And I can see now that, you know, there seem to be more and more people sort of coming here, and that's probably because of a lot of the things that you're doing to attract people to the building. But it is creating a specific Australian history that many of us didn't have in the day. Well, you can see the difference in Canberra from 27,000 when I came here to what, 300 odd thousand now? 300?
More than 300,000.
Yeah.
We have about more than 50,000 school kids come through the building.
Well, that's valuable from the Australian history point of view that, you know, we didn't have that.
And they're learning the civics of it too.
Yes.
You know, that's part of it. But I'm wondering, what did the building impress you at all? Do you have a sense of your first impressions of it?
Well, certainly it was that white building that stood out, and particularly if you went to somewhere like the War Memorial, and you know, it stands out pretty dramatically in the area, in the triangle, it, to me it was always, you know, probably the building, together with say the two big centres in civic, your Melbourne and Sydney buildings, you know, and then from then of course you've had your library and, you know, a few others that have built up. But when I came here, this was, as far as I can remember, you know, the building, if you had one. And it was white, stood out, except on a winter's morning.
What, the fog mist?
The fog and the frost, yes.
And what was the natural environment around it like?
Rose gardens were there then. The coloured trees were very distinctive, you know, like the ones around East Block and West Block, and here and so I was here. That's right. And then the Parliament House, Hotel Canberra, and the Albert Hall. You know, that was, well, the Albert Hall was the centre of a lot of social activity. But they were the distinctive buildings here at
and
the time.
And further on, like, there was no lake.
No lake.
No National Library.
Yeah. No.
What would have been there, you know, like when we looked out from the...
Loosened flats. Loosened flats with a few sheep from time to time. Yeah. The Molonglo River with some willows and... Yeah, there was always the river was there, and the depression area was there in terms of landform. I think they used to cut two or three crops of lucerne a year. It was a very prolific area there. You'd see the irrigation going and the harvesting and so on from time to time. And there were some areas where sheep just roamed.
When you say just roamed, they would have belonged to farmers.
Yes.
And farmers would have been grazing them.
Yes, in that area.
When do you think that stopped? Like in your recollection, when?
When they decided to put the lake in. They must have bought those farms out, because they would have been like the rest of the place on 99-year lease. There'd be no freehold. It'd be all 99-year lease country. So they would have had to buy out the leases, I would imagine, when they decided to put the lake in. Not too sure of the timing of the lake now, but that was in
64.
Yeah, that was. I know. Menzies was pretty keen on the lake and the and the authority to what was it called, the Parliament, the
National Capital Development Commission.
That's it. Yeah, he was very keen on to promote that.
Before we, of course, I'm very keen to ask you about Menzies and Hold, but just a couple of other questions about actually working in the public service back then. Were there codes of conduct and codes of dress?
Codes of dress. Yes, I. There were certainly no thongs and jeans, or t-shirts. It was. You expected to be, well, what up in the scrub would have been your Sunday best, I suppose. Certainly. I'm not too sure about the codes of conduct, but I don't know whether each department had their own sort of things. No, the Public Service Board would have had a code of conduct of some sort, but I don't recall any hard and fast rules on dress. For instance, when most people were getting around in a collar and tie or a suit and tie, I got into safari suits because I thought in summertime I thought they were more appropriate, and that was acceptable. It drew a lot of comments, but you know, I could cop that.
What sort of comments did it draw, and from whom?
Comments from some senior officers, I think, and from some junior officers about being different, I suppose, and how inappropriate it might be. But it wasn't against the rules. I even wore the safari suit sort of when I was working in the Parliament House, and there was no objections, although all your members at that stage were in jackets and ties. There might have been a requirement for a tie then. I'm not real sure on that. Safari suit with a tie just didn't sit too well.
No. And we're talking about the 1950s, so
that's right.
Talking really the Cold War period. I'm wondering about the security clearance aspect. Did you have to go through a clearance?
I certainly did. There were two sorts of clearances. We had in the department, in Prime Minister's department, we had Les McSpearin was our security officer in the department, and he was in charge of the cabinet records as well. And he took the role very seriously. I remember soon after I came, and once I got through my 9 months probation period, I think it was 9 months at that stage, before I was then allowed to go into the public service proper as a permanent member. I think Les sat me down and, you know, gave me the 1, 2, 3 on security and the various classifications of documents. And I suppose it was when I went round to the policy area in the economic area, it might have been before then, that I had a session with one of the ASIO officers, and they frightened the hell out of me, really. At one stage there, I was, you know, I was almost afraid to go to sleep for fear I'd talk in my sleep. You know, some of the briefings I got there about, you know, not being caught in situations where you might be blackmailed for information, you know, no sexual behaviour outside your marriage, and you know, none of this homosexual stuff or anything like that. This was all blackmail material, it was pretty heavy briefing, and of course as I moved further up, and in the service and got more involved in more highly classified material. Because in the economic area, it was just, well, the material was probably, you know, confidential, maybe wouldn't be much secret stuff at that stage. But you'd be seeing some cabinet documents and advising on the cabinet documents and some things. So there would be confidentiality in that. But the briefings got harder as you moved up. And when I was later personal assistant to Sir Alan Brown when he was head of the department, and I saw then every cable that came into and went out of the Commonwealth, from Commonwealth departments, and of course they'd get you up to top secret and osteo and, you know, so top secret and beyond. Then there was more severe, presumably severe checks, background checks and also briefing checks.
In that initial one that you mentioned after your 9 month probation, was there an interrogatory element to it?
It was purely telling you that you had to be careful because there were there could be people around who would want to get information about the government and the government defence and foreign affairs sort of situations and so on, and you could be subject to persuasion to release documents that you might see within the department, and that just wasn't on. No question of whistleblowing those days and handing out confidential or secret reports to the media. Very much frowned upon.
Were you in a union at all?
Yes, the Australian, what is it, ACLA, Australian Clerical Officers Association.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I didn't. I paid my fees, and that was about it. I didn't get involved in union activities. I was interested even after I resigned and went farming in Queensland. I got a bill from the union saying that you owe us a year and a half subscription or something. And I said, well, I resigned on such and such a date at the end of 1968. Yes, but you didn't resign from the union. You might have resigned from the public service, but you didn't resign from the union. I ignored the letter.
Did you work regular hours or were you on call?
I suppose I worked regular hours for the first 5 or 6 years until I got the position of personal assistant to Sir Alan Brown, and that's after I'd worked in the economic area, and I probably worked with him for a couple of years, I suppose, and because working for the permanent head, you can't be an 8:30 to 4:51, I think were the hours at the time, to offset the times I might work after 6 o'clock or beyond, he was quite happy for me when he was busy at a conference or something somewhere. He'd allow me to duck across to Parliament House to have my hair cut. So I used to get my hair cut with a barber downstairs. And that was fine, you know. It kept the barber going too, as you get a few local public servants as well as the parliamentarians.
And I was wondering if you can describe a fairly typical working day. I mean, before you worked for the permanent head.
That was a before then. It was an 8:30 to 4:51, it probably, except when you had things like the Premier's Conference. It was just a standard day. Work varied, and that's one of the things I liked about Prime Minister's Department once I got into the policy areas, that you never knew what you were going to have to cope with the next day, basically. I mean, there was always something new, like, you know, there was the Colombo Plan, the general agreements on tariffs and trade, and, you know, import-export statistics and things like this. And then 1956, I think it was the first Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East conference at Broadbeach, the first one held in Australia, where Lord Casey was Foreign Affairs Minister, and he was the boss boy of that. And Foreign Affairs didn't have enough, or External Affairs, I think they were called at the time, didn't have enough staff to act as liaison officers for the various delegations, and I was seconded to Foreign Affairs for that conference. So, you know, that was something new and exciting, and and that was another real enjoyable experience, and a learning experience, which I was always ready to grab. And of course, in the economic area, there's always something new cropping up. So, although the hours were regular, the content of your work varied quite a lot. But at the time, and once I got to advising on cabinet submissions, advising to the PM on cabinet submissions, Prime Minister's Department at the time, I think, was not so much a post office, but a coordinating department. We were the department that everything to the states or from the states had to come through us to the other departments. We would coordinate advice from other departments, in terms of cabinet submissions and things like that. So it was really a coordinating thing rather than just being a lot of experts in our own any particular area. So it was a coordinating thing to pull advice together for the PM to make judgments. So I think my basic training there was, learning how to assess what was required in terms of government policy or the PM, what the PM would require to make a reasonable decision on a subject, and which departmental advice you'd need to have. So you'd draw in the advice. And so I remember the first cabinet submission that was put on my desk to advise on, and it was on forestry research. Now, you know, I'm a cane cutter's son. I'm a cane farmer's son, and I sort of, what do I know about forestry research? Nil. So I had to talk to the Department of National Development, to the forestry school, and a few things like that, and put them together with this submission and read the submission, and then if I thought there was some extra advice needed from other departments, from Treasury, for instance, or if the submission didn't indicate that they'd been in touch with Treasury or National Development or some other Department of Interior was involved, I would see that that extra advice was obtained. And on the basis of that, you'd form a judgment as to whether the PM should agree with the recommendation, whether it should go to a committee, and if so, who should be on that committee. So it was things like that that the department, the way the department operated it, to a large degree at that stage.
And as you said, it was a very interesting work and
absolutely
stimulating.
Absolutely stimulating.
But I'm wondering, were you ambitious? Like, did you think, were you aiming to become private secretary?
No.
At what point did that enter your consciousness as a possibility, that you could?
It never did until, I'm not sure whether Sir Alan Brown or Jack Bunting, who's succeeding. I think it was Sir Alan Brown called me in one day. And, of course, when the permanent head calls you in, you think, oh, what have I done now? And he said, sit down, Frank. He said, The PM's going to retire in about 2.5 years' time, he said, when he's 70. He said he'd be retiring. He said, I want you to go over and be private secretary and see him out to that time. And I was just rocked, you know, sort of. I was rapt that he thought I had the capacity to do that, and which was great, as far as I was concerned. And you know, it wasn't really he wasn't really asking me if I wanted to do it. It was virtually an instruction from the permanent head. I want you to go and look after the PM's office until the time is out. His time is out. And so he knew, the permanent head knew 2.5 years before Menzies retired that that's what he was going to do. Not like the situation today. He said, people, you would have seen that people say he's arrogant. But he said, I don't think you'll have any trouble working with him. He said, I think you'll have more trouble with Hazel Craig, his other private secretary, who's been with him since 1939, or maybe even before, and it's her prime minister. So she's possessive. And she's been there a long time, and she understands how he works. So you might have more trouble with relationships there than with the PM himself. So I didn't have any option, really. But, you know, I had no intention of aiming for this job. I hadn't applied for this job. It was thrust upon me, if you like. But I think the way I talk to my kids and grandkids now is that you can aim in a certain direction, but who knows where you're going to finish up. You grab the opportunities that come your way. You can, to some degree, gear yourself in a direction, but you're not always going to get where you think you're going to get to initially. And life can be quite interesting if you go with the flow, if the flow's in an interesting direction. And so I had no plans for that job. But I had no regrets at all of having it offered, because it was not the sort of thing you'd even think of rejecting. I mean, if you're in the public service at all. I mean, the opportunity to get to work with someone who'd of Menzies' stature, who had been there for, you know, so long as Prime Minister, to get a position where you could understand, you'd have to understand how Cabinet works, how Parliament works, and, you know, and all the goings on between the political side of the party and the PM and so on, just too big to miss.
And you had been acting private secretary, haven't you, in 1956, is that right?
I did for a while, yes, at that stage, but at that time, the PM and Dame Patty were going to London for a Commonwealth Prime Minister's Conference, and he took with him both his private secretaries, Bill Heseltine and Hazel Craig, and his press secretary, Huey Dash, and Sir Alan Brown from the department, and I think probably his wife went as well, Lady Hilda. So at the time I was working with Sir Alan as his personal assistant, and he said, well, as I'm going too, I want you to go and just look after the PM's office while we're all away. I said, well, you know, what's there to do if the PM's away? And the staff left would have been, I think there were two assistant private secretaries, Betty Greenwood and Murray Helford. I'm not sure whether Mary Newport was there at that stage, but that was the press secretary's secretary. So there were three girls, and they would have been Al Stafford and Chidgey, who were the attendants outside the PM's office, who looked after the the telephone to the PM and the tea and coffee and drinks in the anteroom, the cabinet room for ministers as well as for the PM. So it was a very small office here to look after. But I found that what was required was that I had to send a cable to the PM every day, summarising what was in the major newspapers, you know, how the government was being kicked about on the front pages or the editorials. We had to select, you know, half a dozen papers to look at. And preparing a cable, which then went to Foreign Affairs, what do they call themselves, the communications area there anyway at the time, and sent on to the PM either on board ship, because he went on ship that time, or to our High Commission in London. Now, once the... this gave me my first sort of real look around Parliament House, you know, well, apart from the Premier's Conference bit, but in terms of, you know, working here regularly, I was here for about 3.5 months. And of course, after that, and why it was 3.5 months, after the Commonwealth Prime Minister's Conference was concluded, the PM was on his way back, and I think got about as